because this might be the inner chronicle of what we are, and we have to articulate ourselves, otherwise we would be cows in the field.
I'll just say it. It's fine.
Just do it.
Welcome to Cows in the Field. This is a show where we explore the profound and philosophical in popular films.
See,
Self-important. My name is Justin.
I'm Laura.
So today we're talking about a film that has been heralded as one of the best superhero movies ever. It's the disarmingly charming Spider-Man 2. And we're excited to be joined by Sam Adams. Sam is a senior editor at Slate, where he writes about movies, TV, and popular culture. His writing has appeared in Rolling Stone, the Los Angeles Times, the Philadelphia Inquirer, Entertainment Weekly, and Philadelphia City Paper. Welcome, Sam.
Thank you for having me.
So we wanted to have you on for this episode in particular because you wrote this very wonderful piece for Slate. It was about Spider-Man 2 and the resonance with September 11. And this was, I guess, for the 20th anniversary of September 11 this year. And so we want to start with, when did you first see this movie? Did you see it in theaters? And then what is your experience coming back to it now?
Yeah, I mean, I saw it. This is, you know, like when someone asks how you and your partner met and you're like, well, we were at a bar on a date. Like, it's a somewhat uninteresting story. But I saw it at a press screening before it came out because I was reviewing movies for the Philadelphia City Paper. So I just, you know, went to wherever the schedules had to go that night. You know, and I liked the first movie quite a lot. I felt like Sam Raimi was part of a kind of generation of filmmakers. Joss Whedon, I would have thrown in there at the time, although that's a more complicated name to throw in now. But who really kind of grew up on comic books, like steeped on them and just kind of understood them in their bones in a way that a lot of the previous people who had approached comic book movies going back through the 70s and 80s kind of didn't. They saw them as sort of these weird, you know, conceptual things that they could do sort of interesting stuff with, but they weren't like kind of comic book kids in the way that like Sam Raimi was. And you watch even the, you know, his first movies, the Evil Dead trilogy, and clearly this is a guy who grew up reading way too many comic books, like under the covers at night after his parents told him not to. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he just kind of understood the mythology and the style in his bones. So I was, you know, expecting a lot going into this because I thought the first one was really good. And I was still nonetheless blown away by this. I mean, I particularly remember the feelings I had watching the train scene, which I know we will get to later, but that you know, resonance with September 11th, and this would have been, you know, in 2004. I felt it like right then. It was not something that I kind of came up with later. I was a little worried going back to it now, 17 years later, last year, that it was not going to be there. Because one of the things that, you know, sometimes you deal with going back and revisiting movies is you have this really strong reaction and you go back and revisit it. And you're like, no, like, I don't see it, bro. So I was a little worried. It was, and then you don't want to kind of like force it and be like, no, it's still there. It's great. And then it's not. So I was a little worried that like the magic wasn't going to happen again. And that this piece I had pitched and was pretty excited to write, was not going to happen. Cause I basically was wrong. So I was fortunate, to rewatch it, that it seemed, you know, just as good to me now as it had then. Obviously, a lot has changed in the world of comic book movies since then, and I'm sure we'll talk about that. But to me, that only really underlined the strengths of this movie. There were a lot of things that it couldn't do at the time because audiences just weren't as used to kind of consuming this stuff, you know, three or five or seven times a year or however often they come out now. But I really felt like it understood things that I think even the later movies that are made with bigger budgets and much larger universes and more intellectual property to play around with still don't quite get in the same way.
One of the things I think that is a wonderful synopsis of, I think, of a somewhat universal experience with this movie. I mean, this movie feels, not just this movie, but we just sat down and watched all three of them in the last couple of days, and the three Raimi Spider-Mans. And I mean, revisiting them as a piece, they feel shaggy in the best way. I mean, they really feel like they're just, there's none of the slickness that you get in the like mid part of the MCU. I mean, even really the early part of like even Iron Man in 2008, which is a year after the last Raimi Spider-Man, it feels like it's working almost in a completely different genre. There's such slickness in how these things are presented. And one of the things you mentioned that I think is really poignant is that the audience has just changed. And so the consumer base for this now is somebody who has seen not one or two or three, they've seen like 10, 20 of these types of movies, and they come with rabid expectations. They know a lot of lore and they've been reading the comics. I think, you know, my suspicion is, I mean, I was, when I saw this movie for the first time in theaters in 2004, I mean, I was a fan of comics and that kind of thing, but it was nowhere near the level of lore that I see today. Like where people, you know, I mean, the internet has, I think, made this more extreme in so many different ways, partly because now you just go on a website and have everything broken down. There's videos now that break everything down. And so the casual fan has this just depth of knowledge. And I think one of the nice things about revisiting this movie now is that there's none of that there. It's just like a human story told under the guise of a superhero movie, and not the other way around, where it's a superhero movie and now suddenly let's try to cram a human story into this thing.
Yeah, I mean, one of the fascinating things about this movie is that you know, as I mentioned, you know, Sam Raimi like comes right out of the world of comic books, but the screenwriter for this movie comes from a completely different orientation. I mean, this is, you know, Alvin Sargent, who I think might have been in his 60s or 70s at the time. He's famous for writing the screenplay for Ordinary People.
Oh, wow.
This is, you know, kind of a Hollywood, like, melodramatist, not like some young comic book kid who's really like, oh, maybe I can sneak in a reference to Doctor Strange somewhere. So I think it's kind of a real mixture of this very savvy, knowing, comic book drenched style and directorial approach with this real kind of old school Hollywood melodrama. And I think that's what gives the movie kind of its unique power.
Laura, he was a writer on the Alfred Hitchcock Hour.
Oh, that's fun. that makes so much sense to me. That's the combination that comes with this movie is so earnest in a way that we like don't see anymore. It's so lovely.
I mean, it's literally a movie in which a plot point is that Mary Jane is starring in The Importance of Being Earnest. That's how earnest
it is. It's true. Oh my gosh. I mean, I just feel like there's so many moments where just like they pull in on Tobey Maguire and he just goes, oh gee.
Yeah.
Oh well, boy.
And so much of the drama that these characters are facing is very simple relationship drama.
Yes.
Like the most simple form of a relationship drama. Like, I really like this girl, but you know, maybe I'm just not the right one for her or something. You know, it's almost childlike in its innocence, and I really appreciate that. I just want to mention one thing. So Roger Ebert wrote, and I thought this is really fascinating to me. So this is just a direct quote from his review in 2004. It's not camp, and it's not nostalgia. It's not wall-to-wall special effects, and it's not pickled in angst. It's simply and poignantly a realization that being Spider-Man is a burden that Peter Parker is not entirely willing to bear. And I think that really just, Ebert really nails something there. But I thought what was really interesting about this is it's not camp and it's not nostalgia. I'm like sitting here thinking like, we had another Spider-Man movie this year that we actually haven't seen it, so you can tell us otherwise. But my sense is from reading about it is that it is largely purely nostalgia, wall-to-wall special effects. Not really pickled in angst, but I think it's so interesting that
that's the DC universe.
Yeah, that's the DC, right? It's like Ebert just predicted the next phase of superhero movies here.
Yeah, what I think is, you know, one of the things I should say, one of the things I think is really interesting about this is sort of, you know, what you're talking about, what Ebert is talking about in that review is that this is, you know, centrally a movie about kind of the dilemma of Peter Parker deciding whether or not he can be Spider-Man. And he sort of rejects the mantle in the middle of the movie, or actually the mantle, like, sort of rejects him.
Yeah.
Like, he just loses his powers because he's having this existential crisis. And then he sort of eventually, spoiler alert, figures out a way to syncretize the two, to kind of be both. But it is not a movie about kind of the crushing weight of, oh no, if you're not Spider-Man, the world's going to end.
Yeah.
You can't reject this awesome responsibility. He's like rejecting it because it's a hassle. Like, he can't make the play of that the girl he's loved his whole life is doing. His aunt is, you know, can't pay the mortgage on her house. He's not, you know, getting his homework done for college. I mean, these are incredibly quotidian things that are very important to all of us, but just not traditionally matter in superhero movies at all.
Yeah, no, totally. And I think, you know, that was the other thing that I think is wonderful about the movie is that, you know, it really does set up this conflict in Peter Parker between, okay, I have some sort of obligation to my friends and family and, you know, to some extent myself, but I also have this obligation to, like, the world in a way, right? Like, the city of Manhattan and maybe even the world writ large. And, you know, that is like a thing I think, one of the things we're going to come back to, I think, again and again, but I'll mention it here, is the conflict that it lies at the heart of Spider-Man is in a way a conflict that we all have faced. We've all had to sit, not many of us have been bitten by radioactive spiders, but many of us, I think, have faced that conflict of, like, all right, I've got to do the right thing in some larger utilitarian sense, but I also have to do the right thing, like, to my friends and family. I've got to honor the obligations that I have to them. And that's, you know, it's a lot of times this plays out in other movies, like, as the conflict between the cop who works too much and he's got the family on the side. I'm thinking Heat for some reason. I don't know why Heat's on the line.
Really?
Well, I'm thinking Michael Mann movies because this is a standard Michael Mann conflict.
Yes.
It's like, okay, I've got these, you know, I've got my duty to my job and my career. And I've
and
also...
ladies be getting in the way.
Yeah, ladies getting in the way. So, but I love how it's sort of boiled down because he's a kid, you know, like he's a kid. So the stakes are lower for him than you know, maybe they are in Miami Vice or something.
Well, and it ultimately says, I mean, that you can't do one or the other. You know, if he loses MJ, if he doesn't have the woman he loves, you know, if his aunt loses his home, he can't, I mean, he, you know, physically becomes incapable of being Spider-Man, you know? So it's not like, oh, well, I know, like, you know, my wife and my children are important or whatever, but I also have my duty to the law. It's like, no, you can't, it's not one or the other. You have to do both. And that is, as you're saying, like, that is that's life. You just got to, like, figure it out somehow and, you know, do maybe a sort of 70-80% job of both.
Try to figure it. Yeah, exactly. I mean, you feel this all the time with our child, right, Laura?
That I should just be giving like 70% to the kid.
Yeah.
No, I mean, like, how do I be there for him and also there for myself and also there for you?
Yeah, there's so, like, many, yeah, you just feel pulled in so many different directions.
Totally. Yeah, it's hard. I mean, I think the stakes are low, as you said, in a quotidian way, but emotionally very high. He's trying to figure out who he wants to be. I mean, superhero as reasons aside too. He's a young man trying to figure out who he is.
One line that really stuck out to me this time, and I was kind of rewatching bits and pieces of it this afternoon. And there's one scene in the movie, and I think I have never really dwelt on it before because it's not like one of the scenes that works really well. Like, it's a scene where when Peter's having his sort of existential crisis or web-sistential crisis, he goes to, like, not even a psychiatrist, but just some sort of some, like, random doctor, and then starts telling him that he's, like, having this quote unquote problem, but actually it's his friend who's having a dream about being Spider-Man and then not being able to be Spider-Man. And it's, you know, such a dumb, like, oh, it's not my dream, it's my friend's dream.
Yeah.
Like, that's such a hack little trope there. But then the not psychiatrist, I guess this is the random doctor, says to him, you know, it's gotta like really make you sad not to know who you are, and your soul disappears, and there's nothing worse than that.
What about this friend? Why does he climb these walls? What does he think of himself?
That's the problem. He doesn't know what to think.
Gotta make you mad not to know who you are. Your soul disappears. Nothing as bad as uncertainty. Listen. Maybe you're not supposed to be Spider-Man climbing those walls. That's why you keep falling.
And that, I mean, that just like really hit me this time. Like there is really like nothing worse than kind of not knowing who you are, what you're supposed to be doing, or, you know, all the little in between shades of feeling that like slipping away from you and or maybe I'm this and I'm supposed to be that. And I'm supposed to be these two different things that don't actually fit together. And that is like really painful. One of the things that changed a little bit with me watching this movie, I think I'm maybe a little more less kindly disposed to it now than I was in 2004. But what I would have said in 2004 is, you know, getting very into the subtext of Spider-Man kind of maturing. I think at the time my feeling was this is sort of like the first like adolescent superhero movie, and that it's really trying to like both live out the fantasy and like bring the real life sort of integrate the two. And one of the big images at the end is you know, Peter in the spider suit but with the mask removed, so he's kind of both things at the same time. And part of that is that although it's a little late for his sexual coming of age since he's already in college, like this is a movie where you really see like women in the street like start to notice Spider-Man and to just be like, you know, at one point there's this line like, "One of them, Spider-Man, take me with you." And there's a lot of low angle shots of women in like tight sweaters kind of running into the camera. And I think at the time I was like, oh, you know, at the time I was like, well, look, you know, it's really, there are all these shots of like women noticing Peter Parker, and that's, you know, really kind of reconfiguring the character. And now I'm like, okay, this is also like Sam Raimi, like having a little bit of a thing for boobs. And, you know, so it's like six of one, half dozen of the other. Yeah. You know, it works both ways.
Yeah, totally.
I think one of the things that I also relate to about Peter Parker in terms of him trying to figure out who he is that he's so passive. He's letting sort of all the forces in his life. He's got some really strong people in his life, you know, his Uncle Ben, who left him with this message, you know, that, you know, is his mantra and maybe also kind of haunts him a little bit, this great responsibility line. Aunt May and MJ too is a strong character. And he's sort of like throughout this movie, as he tries to figure out what he's going to do, he kind of bops back and forth in between their guidance a little bit. And, yeah, I find I am also somebody who I think is like heavily influenced by other people's advice, and I find it kind of exhausting if I, you know, get pinballed back and forth between people saying you need to do this and you need to do that, and I'm like trying to figure out what I actually think. And I've watched that going. I feel like Tobey Maguire's performance, I really like it. We were talking a lot about this, especially after the first movie, because the first movie is awkward in so many ways. But I think by choice, I think Tobey Maguire is really great in this Peter Parker role. It's not what maybe what Andrew Garfield was doing, or what is his name? I'm blanking on
Tom Holland.
Tom Holland. Yeah. Thank you. Not at all what Tom Holland is doing, but I think it's a choice.
Yeah, no, I mean, Andrew Garfield is a little bit more of, I mean, I say this with affection because I like his characterization, but I feel like Andrew Garfield's Spider-Man is a little bit more of a prick. He's just a real kind of cocky bastard. And Tom Holland is just, he's the version where they skip the whole Uncle Ben pre-story.
Right.
He's not motivated by anybody getting killed or any need to like avenge their death. He literally enters the Marvel Cinematic Universe just like swinging into frame in Captain America Civil War, just like whooping. Right. Just like, man, it is like great. I'm like a teenager. I have superpowers. I'm saving the world. I'm like, I met Iron Man. This is awesome.
I think the characterization of Peter Parker as a blank slate is intentional, partly because I think the way Sam Raimi wants to read this character, and I have no idea if this is in the comics, I suspect it is that Spider-Man is supposed to be the everyman superhero. He's representative of the everyday person on the street. And this is something you talked about in your Slate piece, Sam, which we've been talking around, we should get to at some point. But by making him basically a blank slate, it's a lot easier for people to sort of see themselves in him. If he had a really strong personality and had lots of, you know, and he was the director of a lot of the action and the driver of a lot of the plot mechanics, I think, you know, it could, you know, he's less of an audience stand-in in that way. And so I think that's on purpose. I think Tobey Maguire plays him really well in that regard, because he's a blank. There's so many shots in this movie where the camera lingers on Tobey Maguire's blank look on his face where he has a half smile and it's incredibly uncomfortable because Mary Jane has just said something very kind to him or something. And then, you know, and then he's just looking at her strangely or whoever he's engaged with. And, you know, I find it endearing, but at the same time, it's very strange in a superhero movie, like to see that now, because you think like, oh, the superheroes, they've got to be like Tom Holland or Robert Downey Jr., these quippy guys who know exactly the right thing to say at the right moment. And he often just doesn't. He's just blank, which I think that's great.
You don't understand. I'm not an empty seat anymore. I'm different. Punch me, I bleed.
I have to go.
Why is this a very good, if not great, superhero movie? And some people, I mean, have said it's one of the best superhero movies. People have said it's one of the best Spider-Man movies. Watching it in close succession with the first one, it was not immediately obvious that this one, to me, was like leaps and bounds better than the first. So just watching them literally back to back. That said, reading your piece brought out a lot of really interesting thoughts. And so your piece is primarily about, or one of the main parts of your piece is about the train sequence.
Yeah. I mean, and this, you know, again, was something that struck me, you know, very kind of viscerally and immediately at the time. But I do still see it there now. I mean, this is, you know, a movie that, you know, was released, you know, a few years after September 11th, but it was still the kind of cultural and political climate had still just been, you know, completely transformed by that. And one of the things that came out of that, and I think lasts, you know, till today, is a real, you know, I think justified veneration of the figure of the first responder.
Yeah.
Who I think, I don't know if most people even knew that term before, you know, the end of, yeah, of 2001, but you know, it's kind of common parlance now. And that's sort of what superheroes are, right? Like they're, you know, in this movie, there's literally a scene, while he doesn't have his powers, where Peter runs into a burning building to save people. You know, they are, and the classic formulation that I remember from the time was, you know, when other people were running out of the World Trade Center, the first responders ran in. And that's what he does in this movie. So he, you know, very nearly sacrifices himself, exerts every kind of iota of strength that he has to stop this train. And he has to, there's a little bit of business where he like gets a spark in his mask and it sort of starts burning away at the eyepiece. So he has to take his mask off. So his whole face is showing. And then he's so spent that this is, and you know, there's a pretty good New York movie in a lot of ways, but Sam Raimi has somehow contrived to have like an L line that runs like right down the middle of Manhattan somehow. So he is, you know, they are dozens of hundreds of feet above the ground or whatever. And so he is so spent at the front of the train that he just, his body goes limp and he's about to just like fall off the tracks and fall, you know, to the ground and presumably to his death. And one of the people who's up there in the conductor's cab catches him and they pull him inside and they pass his body back through the car over their heads. And that image is, I don't even remember if there was like a specific image at the time, but it just felt so resonant that him kind of being rescued by the people who he is supposed to protect. And then Dr. Octopus, who has caused this whole, you know, imminent train crash in order to kind of get Spider-Man off his back. Basically, he realizes that his weakness is that he has to protect the innocent who Otto Octavius or his evil arms that are now controlling him has no trouble killing innocent people for any reason at all. So he is now trying to get, you know, going to get through these people to get to Spider-Man, and the people, they step in front of him. They step between him and this, you know, monster. And they say, you know, if you're going to want to get to him, you're going to have to get through me. And it's funny how watching this again now, I had completely kind of edited out of my mind on the end of that sequence, which is where Dr. Octopus says, okay, fine. I just shove all of them out of the way and take Spider-Man anyway. Because of course he does. Yeah. They're not going to win this fight. But like the gesture was so meaningful to me at the time that really felt like, I was like, oh, well, the scene's over. I don't know. I don't want to know what happens after that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's great. And you're right that there's the parallelism between that scene where they are the ordinary heroes and him when he runs into the burning building as an ordinary hero. I mean, I think it's relevant that this idea of who would run into a burning building, who would run into the burning tower, right, is a trope. It's a trope of like heroism. It's like what you conjure in your mind when you think of a hero.
I know. I'm sorry. I'm only hearing the Tenet trailer in my head. I apologize.
Our son can recite the Tenet trailer. He's two and he can recite the Tenet trailer.
We all think we'd walk and run into the burning building, but until you feel that heat.
Yeah. We just watch it a lot with him. And anyway, it's a long story.
Sorry.
We all believe we'd run into the burning building. But until we feel that heat, we can never know.
Yes, I think that is the feature of true heroism, because it's not having superpowers. It's just being brave and doing what needs to be done in the moment. And I think one of the other things you mentioned in your piece, Sam, which I think is totally right, is although this movie comes out a couple years after 9/11, it is made in the shadow of 9/11, because the first movie comes out a few weeks after 9/11, or
yeah, it was filmed before. There was like a promotional poster with it that had the Twin Powers on it that they then had to like very hurriedly get rid of because no one wanted that association at the time. But yeah, it did come out after and was a huge hit, despite the fact that there is you know, there's a scene in that where the Green Goblin kind of like blows up this big hotel balcony and all this like debris comes like raining down on people in Times Square, which apparently, I don't recall being bothered by it at the time either, but it certainly did not stop the movie from being a big enough hit to spawn two sequels.
Yeah. And I mean, I suspect that in fact, actually, it could be driving the success of the movie at the time, because New York was in that moment a representative of America as a whole. Because it had been the target of the attacks, right? It was like New York and DC, but like DC is supposed to be the representative of America, but it's not really. New York is really the one that everyone's like, oh yeah, that's America.
Well, and also when they talk about DC being the representative of America, like they're only talking about the White House.
Yeah.
They're not talking about like downtown district.
Yeah, that's right. So but New York is like, like they attacked us. Even if I was in Kansas, I'd say they attacked us because they attacked New York. Like New York is a representative of me, of America. And so then having Spider-Man be the defender of New York, he's like the defender of America in a way. Mm-hmm. He's like Captain America in a sense. I mean, there's all these American flag shots too, actually, now that I think about it.
There's a really strong one in 3. I don't remember. There's probably a couple in 2.
I can't remember. I mean,
Now
they're all blurring in my mind, but I remember a couple different shots of him like right in front of an American flag prominently displayed. And, you know, I suspect that in that moment, people in New York and in America feeling vulnerable and feeling like in need of a protector, of somebody who could prevent these tragedies from happening.
The other thing that I think I was thinking about with your piece about the train too, you know, the everyday hero, but also the community that a city is. I mean, it's so many millions of people living incredibly different lives and also a community, but you feel that after a tragedy. You know, I know New York really felt that way, you know, coming together after 9/11. Boston felt that way after the bombing, the marathon bombing, you know, the Boston Strong posters and shirts and were everywhere. And so certainly that was that feeling of like, yes, we, you know, there's millions of people crammed on this island, but also we're a village in some ways, that you feel that on that train.
Yeah.
Right. And I think, I mean, if there is, you know, and not that they need a justification any more than like ice cream needs a justification, but if there's sort of like a larger purpose for these movies to exist, you know, for superheroes to exist, it is to, you know, represent the best of us and to connect us with the best in ourselves. And that is not just, you know, running into the burning building by yourself, but it is also just expressing this, you know, solidarity with each other, like working together in a way which, as you say, like did, you know, exist very briefly after September 11th and then unfortunately went away.
It's hard to maintain as well. No doubt. Because there is, you know, there's that constant push-pull between what you owe to other people and what you owe to your immediate circle and yourself. Yep. And, you know, certainly I think one has a lot more, salience, I feel like.
I like two small comments on the train scene just while we're on it, because these are things that I sort of thought while writing that piece, but didn't really fit into the context of it. One is that, you know, that crowd in the subway car is very sort of, you know, sort of like you know, 40s, like Hollywood stock company, which I like in a way, like just really big sort of like meaty, you know, construction worker looking guys. But it is also especially, you know, compared to like the Tom Holland, the Queens of the Tom Holland movies, that is incredibly white. It is like, have you ever ridden a subway in New York City? and then the other thing, which was just in a piece where I'm talking about kind of 9/11 and like the deeper symbolism of it and kind of getting a little worked up, that wasn't really something I could talk about in the context of the slight piece, is just like what an incredible like action sequence this is to, you know, one of the things that I think has aged very badly about the first movie is all the stuff with the Green Goblin. Like the CGI of that character just looks like dreadful in a lot of places, like actually painful to watch. And this is just, and this is all, you know, a huge amount of CG in the sequence. I mean, Tobey Maguire, if you listen to like the audio commentary for the movie, when they get to the sequence, Tobey Maguire is like, well, I can't really say anything about this sequence because I wasn't there.
That's funny.
Like all the exterior Spider-Man shots are digital for obvious reasons. But the melding of the practical filmmaking and the CG and the practical effects is really, I think, just holds up so well now in a way that even I was just watching for other reasons, The Day After Tomorrow, which came out in the same year as Spider-Man 2, and that also very like CG driven and a lot of the effects, and that just like incredibly like ropey and lousy.
And they did at the time too, right?
Yeah.
Everybody was like, yeah. Ooh.
But I think you could probably pause the shots and point out, you know, where there's not like a lot of, you know, detail in the texturing or whatever. But I think, you know, the way that the effects work with the film waking, you know, and the way that they sort of move the camera to, you know, have the blur cover where they're not going to be able to put as much detail in the digital effects, just works incredibly well, and is so seamless and effective. And I really like, there's no part of my brain that is thinking like, oh, well, that could have looked a little better.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Raimi is a practical guy. But what's going on here feels a lot like what's going on with Cameron and the, you know, with his CGI stuff in the 90s. Like, it really, he just knows when it can be CGI and when it has to be practical. And anytime it's close and you see the tentacles, they're clearly not CGI. They're practical. And there's somebody operating them, you know, and it's great. And then when they need to be doing something more dramatic, the camera's further out and it's CGI, but it's moving quick enough that you can't tell. I mean, the other aspect of the CGI of all three of them, actually, and here I would actually make the case that one is even maybe the best in this regard, partly because I actually don't know how much of it is CGI, is the swinging, is the, yes. the swinging yeah. in the, through the, you know, through the streets. And actually, do you know how they did that? Because here's my hypothesis. In the first one, a lot of those look like what they did was they actually built models and flew the camera through. That's what it looks like. And then they composite or CG'd a spider guy flying in there. And then when we got to the later ones, like especially the 2007 one, then it looked like it's completely CG. And because the camera's doing way more elaborate movement. But it actually, I wondered if it was models plus compositing. Do you know?
I don't know that specifically. I do know that it's, I mean, I like those web swinging scenes that you're talking about. Even from the first movie, I think those really do work the way that the camera will sort of like follow him down between the skyscrapers in Manhattan. And you just get that real, you know, again, there's this kind of giddy sense of like what it would be like to do that. And that's also a place where the camera just gets to like kind of move and spin around a lot. So you're not just like sort of sitting there picking out like the little pockmarks in his suit, which you know, will be doing in some of the more recent movies.
It feels, especially to me in the first one, I don't know why that felt the most, I think because he's doing the least amount of CG, or at least it's doing the least amount with really extreme camera movements. It just looks so good. And a lot of that is weight. I think to this day, we've struggled with capturing weight and mass in computer generated stuff. I'll give another example, actually, just to go back to the first movie. Sorry, because we watched them all in a row. But I like, and maybe I'm an outlier here, but I like the final confrontation between Goblin and Spider-Man because, in particular, now I remember being bad. I remember thinking, oh, this is bad because the background is terrible. It's just like this abandoned church or something, and it's all grimy and dark. But the thing that I really liked about it is that because Raimi, it's mostly just, you know, them hitting each other. And it's not, you know, there isn't really any CGI. And he's moving the camera with the hits. He's doing that Raimi thing where the camera like dollies in, or the camera snap zooms with the punch. And when he doesn't cut on the hit stays there. So you feel the force of it when it hits, and then he lands, and the sound mixing is great. And when he lands, like, you know, we have some subwoofers, and it just rocks your butt when he lands.
You just got to bring up our subwoofers.
Sorry, I bring it up every other episode where I'm like, you know, the subs are rocking.
Only have one subwoofer. Now I feel inadequate, but that's okay.
Please.
Don't get me started, Sam. I tried to convince Van Lathan to get dual subs. But when, you know, he hits and everything, and I was thinking about, we saw Endgame in theaters, you know, oh so long ago. And, you know, that's a loud movie too. But in that CGI mush of a battle at the very end, I didn't feel this any of the weight. I didn't feel any of the, yeah, these guys are hitting each other and sending dudes flying. And there's like, you can tell Thanos is super powerful and everything. But I didn't feel like anyone was being hurt in the way that I feel when Goblin hits Tobey Maguire and he lands and the dust is kicked up. And I felt like he knocked the wind out of him. It felt visceral in a way that I just haven't felt in a superhero movie in a long time.
Right. It's interesting, like the way that, and I think there is, you know, to their credit, like a little bit of this in No Way Home, the most recent movie where Willem Dafoe's Green Goblin also plays a significant role. You know, this is a villain who has his like glider and his goblin bombs or whatever they're called. Great things. Sorry, but read a lot of comics when I was a kid, but not Spider-Man so much. Mm-hmm. But basically his sort of signal power in the movies is just that he punches really hard.
Yeah.
You know, he just clocks him right in the face or the chest or whatever. And that, but it, yeah, he's just like a boxer.
Yeah.
Basically. So yeah, so that sense of that impact is really important because that's kind of what he does.
That's what he does. Yeah. I mean, here's another aspect of just because we're on practical stuff, this scene. And this I think was my favorite scene. Maybe I'm a lunatic, but this is my favorite. I don't think this is a crazy opinion. My favorite scene of Spider-Man 2 was the operation scene.
That's not a crazy opinion.
I just think it's what a wild and crazy scene. So this is the scene when they're like, okay, Dr. Octopus, he's got these things fused on his spine now. We gotta saw them off. First of all, the wide shot of that is incredible because he's laying face down and then they've draped these things over his, you know, arms, which are suspended from the ceiling or whatever. It's incredible.
Like a weird, like Louise Bourgeois sculpture. Or
yeah.
Like moment. Yeah.
Totally. It actually reminded me of that scene in Silence of the Lambs when Lecter guts the guy and drapes his body.
Because of the
up.
Drapes. Oh,
yeah. Because yeah, the yeah. drapes. I was yeah. like, and the way it's lit too, it's really intensely lit.
We won't know the extent of the damage until we get in there. So I suggest we cut off these mechanical arms, slice up the harness, and if need be, consider a laminectomy. With posterior spinal fusion from C7T1 to T12.
We're ready, Doctor.
Anybody here take shop class?
Anyway, I loved that scene. And that's a scene where I think almost everything in that scene is practical, right? He's got like the saw and I, you know, it's totally like Evil Dead, you know, callbacks.
Yes, he's got the octopus of arm vision.
He's got arm vision. He's got the doctor like looks over, cameras whips over to the saw there. He's got his weapons. And, you know, anyway, I really enjoyed that scene. And I think part of the reason I enjoyed it is because it felt like a scene in a movie that doesn't, you know, in a superhero movie that doesn't exist anymore, because it would normally be a CGI fest, even if it was done in this campy way. But I love just the weight of everything in that scene. Everything's glistening. It's all metal. Anyway, it's
right. Great. And he makes it like fairly clear within the context of, I think this is a PG-13 movie, but he makes it fairly clear that like Otto Octavius like straight up murders all the people in that operating room. You know, it isn't just sort of like, you know, punch them and knock the wind out of them. Like he basically is like crushing their skulls.
Yeah.
Sawing them. Yeah.
With chainsaws. And yeah. I don't remember exactly why there's a chainsaw in there, especially why it's like chrome plated, but yeah, details.
Yeah.
It's awesome. That's why.
I think the answer is it's a Sam Raimi film. These guys happen to wander into a Sam Raimi film and they're like, well, here you go. You're arming yourself with it. You got to have a chainsaw.
You got to have Bruce Campbell in every movie and you got to have a chainsaw.
Oh my God. Okay. Let me ask you this. best Bruce Campbell cameo of the three? Do you remember all three? So the first one is he's the announcer in the ring. The second one is he's the usher who won't let Peter Parker into the thing. And the third one, he's the French waiter.
It's a tough call between the first two because they're both just kind of different, like, flavors of like Bruce Campbell's smarm. But I think I'd go with like the wrestling announcer, at least for attire, if no other reason. Clearly the snappiest dresser.
What did you think, Laura? Did you have a favorite?
The third movie is so silly, but I did kind of like the current, like the gag? Recurring gag, yeah. Where he keeps thinking that he's signaling to propose to Mary Jane, and Campbell's got just the most absurd French accent.
Yeah.
He loves love.
He does. Yeah. Also, is that a thing where you put the ring in the glass and then you
put it? Yeah, you didn't do it, but it is a thing.
But wait, what I thought was going to happen is the glasses were going to come out and the bottle was going to come out separate, and then they were going to combine them and the ring would be in there and she would notice, rather than the ring being in the glass filled with liquid so she could potentially choke on it.
I think it's usually already in the,
really?
In the drink.
It does seem like a bad idea anywhere except in a movie to like put a small object in a glass of liquid that you hand somebody and hope
I don't know anybody who's actually
swallow
been,
it.
Right.
Yeah. Also, like, a ring is gold, right? And our... Well, yeah, usually they're gold.
Platinum. No, I'm just kidding.
Okay, well, whatever. And the champagne is also kind of gold color. It's a very real chance you might not notice it. Anyway.
Yes, or that, you know, if the person you're proposing to, like, drinks a glass of champagne and feels like some solid object in their mouth, their reaction is going to be, oh, this must be a pleasant surprise.
Yeah, exactly. They're like, oh, you're trying to marry me. That's it. Well, to bring it back to something serious now, so I wanted to ask, the other thing I love about these movies is that, and I think the third one kind of screws this up, actually, but is that Spider-Man, is his origin is founded on guilt. And I think that's like a really powerful feature of the origin story of Spider-Man, that, you know, what causes him to become Spider-Man is not being bit by a radioactive spider. It's not when he goes and you try to wrestle for money when he gets the moniker initially, but it's that he fails to act in a moment when he should have acted, and he realizes this. He thinks, and I think that having his uncle's blood on his hands is like, I don't know, that I feel like is the most, one of the most interesting and profound superhero origins, because he then, his whole like life as a result of this is tainted by that melancholy and that guilt and that self-loathing in a way. And that self-doubt that, like, if I made the mistake once, I could make the mistake again. I think that makes this character super relatable in a way, because it makes it just builds on your point, Sam, that he's an everyman and that he's a guy in New York, and that, he's going through issues that we have all gone through, because we've all made mistakes. We've all said something we regret and then had to go back and try to make amends or not, and then had to just live with that guilt. And I think that where the movies I think are most successful for me are when Spider-Man is dealing with that. And in this film, you get it when he talks to Aunt May and he confides in her and says,
Uncle Ben was killed that night for being the only one who did the right thing. I held his hand when he died. Tried to tell you so many times.
If my favorite scene is the Doc Ock arm removal scene, I think that's the most potent scene for me, because it's just I see, you know, he's holding back tears almost the entire time, and I think it's an incredible. I love also that they don't resolve it, that she just gets up and leaves. There's not any cathartic resolution in that moment. I think it's quite daring, actually, for a blockbuster to live in that state of challenging emotion for so long.
Right. I mean, I am like 70% sure I'm stealing this from someone else, some article that I read back when I was researching the piece in September, but I can't remember who. So then I'm going to pretend I came up with it. but the idea is basically that, you know, Spider-Man stories are kind of, in essence, like, they're, what distinguishes Spider-Man and what distinguishes Peter Parker is that he doesn't want to be Spider-Man. Mm-hmm. You know, he is a superhero, really kind of would rather not have to do this. And it's not like because he's a bad guy, but it's just because like this is just like a lot
tough
to deal with. And like, well, you know, who else feels like every mugging in a city of 8 million people is their responsibility? But he kind of has to bear that burden, and he will like deal with the responsibility, but it's something that, if he could shirk off, he still might. I mean, that is definitely not true of the current iteration of the character, but kind of classically. And I think it's what makes, I mean, I've really come to think of him as, you know, one of the most important, just in iconic terms, like one of the most important, comic book characters ever. I mean, you know, on a level with Superman, because, you know, just because he's so characterized by this ordinariness and this desire to, you know, reject this thing. You know, Superman is always going to be Superman. Like, Superman is the hero is the real person, and Clark Kent is the made up identity. And, but Spider-Man is always Peter Parker, even when he's wearing the suit. And that's what kind of classically, you know, separated Marvel from DC right at the beginning. That was what, you know, Stan Lee and Jack Kirby and Steve Ditko were going to bring to the medium with some kind of, you know, little bit of like psychological realism, and, you know, kind of daily lives. But I don't think, you know, the X-Men would go to like, you know, beatnik coffee shops and stuff, but they didn't, they didn't have like real lives in the way that Peter Parker did. And I think that just, you know, seems like such an important turning point for the medium.
I mean, just to go back to one thing we said earlier about the balancing, the conflict between him of he doesn't want to be Spider-Man, but he feels that burden of the responsibility. It's not just that he feels like, oh, I've got these superpowers. My uncle said, you know, you got the superpowers, you got to use them. Rather, it's that he feels like every time he fails to intervene to help someone, he's failing himself and his uncle every time again. It's like a reminder of that failure from that is his origin. And I think that makes it weightier than just if he was a guy who got superpowers all of a sudden and was then like, maybe I should do this for good, but also, you know, I want to have a girlfriend or something. It's not a trivial choice for him, because I think he, you know, if he was in therapy, this would be the kind, you know, this would be the sort of things his therapist would be working with him on, trying to explain, like, okay, when the mugger gets away with it, it's not your fault. But he's going to always feel that.
And I don't think there's ever a moment in any telling of the story where it even like briefly entertains the idea that by catching the mugger who killed his uncle, justice has been served and his mission is over. Like, I don't think there's even like an eye blink of, oh, good, well, that's okay now. And then, you know, the siren world, or he sees someone else getting their purse stolen, and then he's like, oh, I guess I have to do that one too. Like, it just, his soul is like never going to be at peace with that.
Yeah. I was joking with Justin. I was like, this doesn't seem that hard. Just like set a quota, you know, like do like 3 rescues a month and then Netflix and chill with your girlfriend. Like, you don't have to do everything. But yeah, of course, he, you know, he's the trauma and the guilt. He can never sort of halfway do it.
Yeah. I mean, here's another thing. And I think my suspicion is that this is a Raimi thing, because I was thinking about this and I was like, oh yeah, what I'm about to say, I feel like I've seen this in a lot of Raimi films. The villains in each of the 3 movies are basically not themselves evil, but they're possessed by an evil entity, basically, that like, or a thing that turns them evil. It just, you know, in the Green Goblin, it's like the gas that makes him, you know, makes him go mad. In Dr. Octopus, he's literally taken over by an artificially intelligent arms system. And in Venom's an alien, right? He's like some sort of alien symbiote. I mean, maybe Sandman less so. I'm not totally sure how to fit Sandman into this, but those 3 at least. And then I was thinking about this and I was like, yeah, these are all like these guys, like they're not really evil, but then they get sort of taken over. And then I was like, oh yeah, that's Evil Dead, right? Isn't that just like everything that happens in Evil Dead? That's Drag Me to Hell. There's like in all these movies, Raimi's interested in this idea that there's like a plane of pure evil. Maybe it's hell, or maybe it's like this afterlife world of like demons and things. And that plane like interacts with ours. Like they kind of, these demons like come into our world and mess around and mess shit up on our planet. But humans are fundamentally decent in a way, right? We're just like, we're corruptible, but we're decent. And if you think of it that way, then the climax of this film really is not a big battle, right? It's just this moment where Peter Parker, you know, Spider-Man slash Peter Parker, because he got the mask off, reminds Dr. Octopus of his own humanity. He says, hey, remember, you're a good guy. And Dr. Right. Octopus is like, oh, yeah.
You once spoke to me about intelligence. That it was a gift to be used for the good of mankind.
A privilege.
These things have turned you into something you're not. Don't listen to them.
No, it's really striking to rewatch it and remember that, like, you know, the train scene is clearly like through the apex of the movie, yeah. But it's not the climax. But the scene after that is basically just Peter kind of talking Otto Octavius into killing himself, mm-hmm. Which is a weird climax for a superhero movie. Like, he doesn't defeat him at all. You know, part of that's because in these, you know, the Spider-Man like doesn't kill this version. So the villains all have to kind of die some other way. But it also is, I guess there are sort of these external forces acting, and then the goblin gas or whatever, and Otto's arms. But it does also seem to me that, and this is kind of pure comic book too. I mean, these villains are just, in the case of Green Goblin, sort of literally externalized versions of their own worst tendencies. I mean, Norman Osborn is like arguing with himself in the mirror. And in the way that, the spider suit kind of brings out like the best in Peter Parker, the goblin suit, the arms kind of bring out the worst in Norman and Otto, I guess I'll call them since we're friends.
You're totally right. It's not as if something alien takes them over and then they're not themselves. It's that it's like they're drunk, right? Like, and people say this like, oh, when you get drunk, it's like, what was there gets amplified. So if you were sad, right. You get more sad. And if you're happy, you get more happy. And it, so it takes some seed that was already there and just, takes it to the extreme.
Yeah. And the good was there too. Like, that's real, but it just kind of loses, like Otto Octavius has these dreams of whatever it is, like fission or I don't even know, but he's got, he's got like a loving wife and a seemingly like a very happy marriage. But just is, a little too caught up in like having the power of the sun in my own hands or whatever. And then that and the loss of his wife just kind of, who I guess is his, his tether or something in this thing, just sends him over the edge.
Totally. Yeah. And I think I went back and looked at that scene just because I wanted to remind myself what happened. And I think that it is striking that the language that they use is exactly, it's setting up a parallel between Dr. Octopus and Peter Parker. So like, yeah, he basically says,
it was my dream.
Sometimes to do what's right, we have to be steady and give up the thing we want the most, even our dreams.
You're right.
Because that's him trying to convince Dr. Octavius that he can't have the tritium or whatever powered sun thing that he's been working his whole life towards. He has to convince him to give that up, that dream, just like Peter Parker has had to give up his dream of just living a normal life, just like dating, Mary Jane and being a scientist or whatever he wanted to do.
That's such a sweet line that I don't know that we'd see in a Marvel movie now. It's so earnest.
I don't want to hate on
that's,
Marvel.
I think that's like that Alvin Sargent magic. They're like, yeah. I can imagine like Timothy Hutton saying that in Ordinary People.
Yes.
Or probably more of a Judd Hirsch line, actually. But yes.
So obviously, as one thing we mentioned at the top, this movie, it comes in a moment when the audience is less savvy about superhero movies. Now it's very different. That's a big change. What else, Sam, for you has changed regarding superhero movies? I mean, the market is much more saturated with them now, it seems. But at the same time, where do we also think these superhero movies are going? Like, where are they headed next?
Yeah, I mean, just to sort of establish my own position on this, either my, credibility or just my age. I was 12 when I bought a ticket for my regular comic book shop to see like an early Saturday morning screening of the first Batman movie before that came out. And I mean, I still like just remember like the way that crowd reacted when there's that shot where like the bat plane like goes up above the clouds and like hangs in the moon and makes the bat symbol. And like, that is probably one of like the top 10 like craziest noises I have ever heard in my life. Like, you just can't imagine how a bunch of comic book nerds who'd been, you know, putting up with people making like bam pound noises every time someone said the word Batman their whole lives, reacted to that moment. It was just like, you know, now in retrospect, it was, it sort of seems like, you know, I don't know, mixed blessing, I guess. But yeah, so I mean, I just having been through, you know, all the sort of Batman movies and their eventual turn into camp, and then the Raimi movies, which I was like, oh my God, like people are really like getting what these movies are about. And it, you know, it's been in some ways great, you know, to like see that, you know, language that I like valued so much sort of pass more into the vernacular, and that battle like not have to be, you know, fought all the time. I mean, Marvel is like such a crazy juggernaut now. I mean, we're dealing with, I was looking at the numbers this morning, you know, No Way Home has now made $1.3 billion in, you know, less than a month since it opened. It essentially like obliterated the pandemic for financial purposes. Like it is the one movie to which COVID makes no difference whatsoever to its box. Like maybe it would have been a little higher, but it's already like the 12th highest grossing movie of all time, and it's not anywhere near done. So, you know, it's a little bit like a frightening juggernaut now. And I think, you know, the Marvel movies have gotten like a little bit cool in a way that I sort of, as someone who feels like I've kind of fought in the trenches of like nerd justification, sort of rubs me a little bit the wrong way. There's a scene in the new movie, a moment that was in the trailers actually, where Otto Octavius, you know, shows up, is first introduced to Tom Holland's Peter Parker, and he's like, and he and I think just sort of like, you know, start snickering, and they're like, really, like you got eight arms and your name's like Otto Octavius, you know, like you know, and I'd sort of forgotten that there's a similar moment in Spider-Man 2. But it's just framed very differently. Like J. Jonah Jameson like throws up this line, like a guy named Otto Octavius ends up with eight arms. What are the chances? And then it just like cuts away to him. And that was like, you know, there's like a little Doctor Strange reference in there too. And that was just like, oh my God, like they snuck that in the movie. They like got away with that. That seemed so cool in 2004. And now it's just like the thing that the characters in the movies, I like, kind of laugh at, and they're like, they're too cool for, like, what a dork, you know, I can't believe this guy's name is Otto Octavius and he has eight arms. And I feel like they've lost the core sense. Like I feel like in order to really kind of understand like how superhero stories work, like I think you have to be on some level in touch with the fact that they're just like super goofy and kind of silly, and also like incredibly moving and can really, you know, work on parts of your psyche that, you know, more sort of self-serious stories won't, because you just have to like let go of something. You're not, you know, if you're sitting there going like, oh really, so the guy named Otto Octavius is going to end up being Dr. Octopus, like you know, if you're doing that when you're watching Spider-Man 2, like just turn it off and go do something else. Like you just got to give up the part of your brain that is going to like scoff at that. So the fact that it has now been like integrated into the MCU like bums me out a little bit, because I feel like they've lost that sort of elemental innocence, you know, that melodramatic core that makes a movie like this work so well. So it's, you know, sort of neat that they're like so successful, and I don't know that it's like any better or worse than you know, whatever like Michael Bay or Roland Emmerich movies or whatever the hugest things were before this. But I feel like they've become like a little too high on their own supply. Some of this is just like, you mentioned the word nostalgia right at the beginning, and some of this is just my nostalgia when it felt a little bit more like movies like this were getting away with something, which is always kind of the most exciting quality in a movie. You know, some of the Marvel movies are very good. I don't think any of them are like outright terrible. So I don't know, is that a conclusion? Like it's mostly pretty good, not entirely. You know, I mean, they're a giant like corporate juggernaut in an era where we're not supposed to be skeptical of corporate juggernauts anymore, which is itself, I think, a pretty dangerous force. But that is a rant for some other less,
I mean, where
much do you, much more boring podcast, I think. So.
Where do you think it's going? I mean, I just having surveyed and been in this world for so long and seen the trends and seen the, you know, how the ebbs and flows of pop culture and this sort of embrace and the hatred of superhero movies. And now, you know, because I was mentioning to Laura, like, I don't know how much, Laura, you were paying attention to like the ebbs and flows of culture in, but in particular, this kind of nerdy pop culture stuff.
Absolutely none.
Zero. No. but I mean, in 2008, and Sam, you will know this, when Iron Man and Dark Knight come out, that was the year I remember, I mean, it was probably said before, but I remember distinctly people saying in that year when we were getting Iron Man and Dark Knight, we were like, do we really need more superhero movies? People, I mean, this was being said loudly, and people were like,
you're like, come really? On. Two in the same year? Are you seriously?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And I mean, now, I mean, you know, whoever said that, but it probably was me among many other people, were like, oh, yeah, now we just, you know, the egg is on our face. So, but I'm just curious what you think, like, I mean, is this what Marvel's doing now sustainable, or are they going to have to pivot? What do you think?
I mean, they're pivoting now. I mean, ultimately, like, every trend burns itself out sooner or later. Yeah. So probably not. Whether it's going to take, you know, 5 years or 10 or 20, I don't know. I mean, I definitely feel quite a bit of storytelling fatigue in the phase four movies that are coming out. Everything sort of post the end of Endgame. You know, it really feels like they're searching for new kind of main characters to hang a new set of stories on and not really finding them. I found, you know, some of the minor characters in the new movies, like, you know, Florence Pugh in Black Widow, Awkwafina in Shang-Chi, you know, some of the sort of lesser characters in Eternals, although not really any of them so much, you know, to be pretty engaging. And a lot of the leads, you know, like Richard Madden and Gemma Chan in Eternals and Simu Liu and Shang-Chi, to just really be kind of drips, to really not be very interesting characters. I think, you know, one of the reasons why, you know, Eternals flopped and the Spider-Man movie has done so well is because Tom Holland is just like a much more engaging actor, but he's also, you know, he's a carryover from the first wave. And I think they're really struggling to, they've already gone through like all the big characters that people know, managed to, you know, introduce people to some that they probably wouldn't have thought so much about before. It does seem to me like they're really, you know, having trouble coming up with new stories that merit that sort of, you know, like global billion-dollar treatment. And, you know, and the TV shows, which I've all been, you know, mostly watching for work, although I have to admit, like, I haven't finished either of the last two, either What If or Hawkeye. I might at some point. It wasn't a, like, I decided I wasn't going to. I just kind of missed an episode. And she's like, you know, maybe I'll finish it at some point. I really do feel like, you know, they're kind of running out of stories. And I'm sure they will find something else to replace it. But, you know, Marvel is just like such a unique cultural force right now. I mean, there's, you know, it is basically the Death Star. I mean, there's nothing else that can even come close to approaching it in terms of, you know, cultural dominance, you know, time, you know, wears this all down eventually. So I'm sure
that's
that'll
right.
peter
yeah.
out someday.
In terms of cultural dominance in this household, I believe it's Tenet. It's Tenet and Zootopia.
Yeah.
The big two. Yeah.
Current obsessions of our
current
two and
obsessions.
A half year olds.
Myself, I've burned out on these Marvel movies. We watch them periodically now, but after Endgame, I was like,
hard to watch them periodically though, because Endgame we tried to watch all of them, but we missed Iron Man 3. And then we watched Shang-Chi and the whole, like, there's like a whole subplot about Iron Man 3. We're like, damn it, it's the one we missed.
We are not pop culture literate anymore. We were at one point, and we are no longer.
I mean,
and
I honestly feel like they are choosing things now to like punish people for like not to admit. They're like making you go back and watch the bad ones. Like they built a whole, you know, a whole like Loki series about, you know, Thor the Dark World, which is by universal acclaim either the worst or the second worst movie in the entire series. And it's like, well, too bad. Now they're doing a Hulk series where they're going to bring back, you know, Tim Roth's character from the terrible Hulk movie. And it's just like a sort of evil like flex at this point. Like, look what we can make you watch. You know, you thought you were going to skip the bad ones, but no, you're going to have to go back and do your homework.
You're going to be confused in Shang-Chi. Who's Ben Kingsley? Who is that guy?
It didn't really matter. He has this monologue, and I thought it was hilarious. I'm like, oh, Ben Kingsley's in this movie. And then we're like, wait a second, Ben Kingsley was in Iron Man 3. Okay,
well,
hold on.
Like, remember when you tried to take over the world? And I'm like, he did?
What? Well, I know. I was just like, oh, that's backstory. Just like, you know, he's giving backstory to his character. Anyway, whatever. Is it possible to be a casual Marvel fan? We're about to find out, because we're probably going to watch like one of the every four of them that gets released, and we'll see if we can follow along. What I want to ask, the last thing I want to ask you, so because we're talking to Spider-Man 2, and what's your ranking of the Raimi Spider-Mans? Like, where, what, you know, 1, 2, 3, what are your faves?
I think that's pretty easy. As much as I like the first two, I mean, I would suspect you find having difficult finding anyone who wouldn't go 2, 1, 3, but I will go. Yeah. I will go 2, 1, 3.
2, 1, 3. Yeah. Laura, can I get yours?
I think it's 1, 2, 3. Am I crazy?
Laura,
nuts?
We kind of love the first one.
Well, I'm a weirdo, I guess. I mean, I hadn't revisited these in so long. So it was like, I sat down being like, oh gosh, this might be, you know, cheesy and dated and for number one. And I was kind of blown away by it. So maybe one got a little bit of a boost.
Got the halo.
Just because, yeah, exactly. It was like the first revisit for any of the Raimi ones. I kind of really love Willem Dafoe and what he's doing. I feel like I wanted more of that for Doctor. I feel like we could have let Alfred Molina do more in number two. I loved the camp of it. I liked the smaller scale of it. And I liked the origin story, which I don't often like. So I, strangely, 1, 2, 3 for me.
1, 2, 3. Here's my pitch for one. This is the only one that has the Chad Kroeger song at the end. Which I love that Kroeger song. When that song hits, I'm like, my fists are in the air. I'm rolling.
You don't like the Dashboard Confession one for number two?
I don't like I like that
How
song.
Dare you?
But I like the
Kroeger.
No, I'm legit. I like that Kroeger song. Like with Josie, whatever, Josie Wales or whatever his name is. I don't know, it's not his name. Josie, the guy from Saliva.
This is just not where I thought this discussion was going to end up.
So. We alienated everyone.
I'm so sorry, but Justin does play that song like a lot in our house.
I dig that song.
It's not a bit.
I like it. And I like how earnest it is. So Sam, thank you so much for being here. This was a wonderful conversation. We really appreciate your time. Can you just briefly tell the audience where they can find you, like on social media, and where they can read you?
Yeah, I am on Twitter, far too much for my own good, at Samuel A. Adams. And you can read me fairly regularly in the virtual pages of Slate.com. Thank you very much, guys, for having me. This was a lot of fun.
Cheers. And
thank you.
We are at CowsPod on Twitter. You can find us on the web at cowspod.wordpress.com. Thank you very much for listening. In 2 weeks, we'll be talking to Eric Hatala-Mathis about The Usual Suspects. So we'll be talking about the philosophical question, whether you can, in good moral faith, engage with the art of bad people. So that's what we'll be talking about. Anyway, thanks so much. See you guys next time.